Good evening and welcome to the sixth presentation in this our 17th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, back here taking pictures, Hai Wong Wan, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadon Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of Fort Wayne, Indiana. He attended Concordia College, received an MA in History and MLS from Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, and his DPhil from Clare Hall at Cambridge. He's taught history at LSU, Lamar University, and was head of the History Department at the University of Central Arkansas before assuming his current position as Dean of Arts and Science at Athens State University in Athens, Alabama. His early research focused on the Tudor-Stuart period of English history. He since expanded his interest to include the history of the great discoveries and historical legends. He's the author of 11 books. Among the most popular include Legends and Lore of the Americas before 1492, published in 1993, Travel, Legend, and Lore, published in 1998, New Worlds, The Great Voyages of Discovery, 1400 to 1600, published in 2002, and Invented Knowledge, False History, Fake Science, and Pseudo-Religions, published in 2009, which seems especially appropriate for our times, and has been translated into many different languages. In his newest book, Egyptomania, A History of Fascination, Obsession, and Fantasy, published in 2016 by Reaction Press in London, he describes how ancient Egypt has been the focus of awe and fascination from its beginning in the age of the pyramids to today. When not teaching or writing, Ron is a frequent speaker in the Rhodes Scholar Program in Alabama and also gives talks on cruise ships in the Mediterranean. Please welcome Ron Fritzi. Ron.
Well, thanks for coming, everyone. It's a real honor to be here. And Brian informed me that I guess George Martin's in town talking about Game of Thrones. So, I mean, I'm glad there's somebody here, you know, because I said over supper, I said, well, gosh, I guess if it was up to me, if I wasn't a speaker, I might go see George Martin, you know, because I got sucked into being a Throny. So, anyway, we'll talk about Egyptomania. And one of the things is I need to start out with a full disclosure because I am not an Egyptologist. I am a historian. As Brian said, I studied at Cambridge with Sir Geoffrey Elton. And actually, he'd kill me for writing a book like this, okay, because he liked to keep all of us working on Tudor England. And I'm not the first one that's drifted away from that, but he'd still be chiding me all the time. But anyway, he's gone, and so I guess I can get away with it. But so I'm not an Egyptologist. And another thing I wanted to bring up about the book, at one time when I gave a talk, one of the people in the audience really thought this was going to be a book about the history of ancient Egypt, and it's not. There's a chapter about the history of ancient Egypt to give you an overview, but otherwise it's a history of the idea of ancient Egypt, mostly in Western culture and what we think about it. And so it's about the Egypt of the mind, not the physical Egypt itself. And as a result, like, for example, the way the book's structured, there's the chapter on the history of Egypt, and there's eight chapters that chronologically trace Egyptomania through up until after King Tut, and then there's four topical chapters that look at occult Egyptomania, pseudo-historical Egyptomania, Afrocentric Egyptomania, and then Egyptomania in fiction. Okay, so anyway, that's the way the book is structured. Well, what is this Egyptomania? And the simple answer is it's a fascination with ancient Egypt in its many aspects. Okay, and you can go into more detail from that, but I think you get the picture about that. And when we say that, you know, but it's really a fascination not just with Egypt; it's about the myth of Egypt. Okay, not the real Egypt. I've only been to Egypt once, and I think a lot of times when people go there, when you read travel accounts, they come away a bit disappointed in some ways. It depends on where you go. But I mean, like, for example, we started in Alexandria, and actually I was reminded of Gary, Indiana. Okay, so anyway, it was, and the fact of the matter is, that goes way, not the classical Ptolemaic Alexandria, but going up through the 19th and large part of the 20th century. I mean, Vivant Danon, when he got there with Napoleon, he said, this is very disappointing. So anyway, because it wasn't a big town and stuff, but actually, when you see the monuments, now, for example, I was not disappointed by the pyramids, okay, but you're going along and, you know, people look and go, well, this country looks like a wreck, and that's because there's a lot of houses and things that are, look like they're incomplete. And they're incomplete because what happens a lot of times in countries like Egypt, where the currency's not very stable, when people get money ahead, they add on to their houses. And another thing is, in like a middle-class Egyptian society, if you have a son, he can't get married. A girl's family will not let her marry a guy who's not got a house to move into, or a flat, or something like that. So the parents, when a boy's like 2-3 years old, will buy an unfinished flat, and they'll spend money over the years to get it habitable by the time he reaches marital age. And as that's one reason why the buildings look like they do. It's not that they're dilapidated, they're actually under continuous construction. So anyway, so it's about the fascination with the myth of ancient Egypt. So what form might Egyptomania take? Well, here's a good example. Okay. I bought that at the British Museum, so never say that they don't have a sense of humor. And in fact, not only did I buy one, I bought two. I got one for home and one for the office. And like I said, I'm a Tudor Stuart historian. You can get a Henry VIII rubber ducky, but I didn't buy one of those. I bought this instead. So again, I got, you know, bit by Egyptomania. And one of the things I came to realize is that you'll run into Egyptomania or Egyptianisms in the oddest places. I was actually reading, I had an audio book that I got of this novel, The Counterfeit Heiress. And I don't know if you're familiar with Tasha Alexander, but it's set in late 19th century England, and in this one it's set in 1897. And what happens is, it's the Lady Emily series, and Lady Emily and her friends go and try and find this wayward friend of theirs who's been over in Paris. The woman's a recluse. Her name's Estella, Lady Estella Lamar. She's been kidnapped. And, well, it turns out, if you look closely at the cover picture, that's the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. And so a guy's got her down in a crypt where he's kidnapped her. And he's not a bad person necessarily, but he was a little bit of a confidence man. And so he makes sure she's well fed and she's got books, and she's such a recluse, she doesn't actually mind being down in this crypt. And one of the things that happens is he gives her Belzoni's narrative of his explorations in Egypt. She falls in love with Egypt, and he gives her more and more and more of these books. And I thought, wow, that's completely unexpected, because the other thing is, I'd been in Paris and got to go out to Père Lachaise, and you know, I was going to see Champollion, the decipherer of the hieroglyphics grave, but I wanted to see others. I saw like Michelet's, and of course I went by Jim Morrison's grave and that type of stuff, and everything too. And it's very interesting. I messed up though, because I did not realize that Vivant Danon was also buried out there, and has a really interesting monument that I saw a picture of. But anyway, the novels are pretty good. Actually, I've now read two of them by Tasha Alexander, and they're good fun mystery reads. Okay, and visual images also promote Egypt. You know, for example, we all know this about the golden mask of King Tut. I have not seen it in person, because when the second Tut tour came to Chicago and I went to see it, they didn't have the golden mask on that one. But you know, obviously, you know, gosh, you know, that poor golden mask gets overused on book covers all the time. I mean, who would do such a thing? So, anyway, Actually, I didn't pick the book cover. I wanted the rubber ducky for the book cover. Now, when I was in primary school, for example, I went to a parochial school from second grade through eighth, and I went to a parochial high school as well, and also went to Sunday school. And again, one of the things you see is that you go to, Sunday school and the Bible classes, and there's all kinds of neat illustrations and stuff. And the ones when the children of Israel are in Egypt are, always have really good romanticized pictures of Egypt, and the thing is, looking Joseph in Egypt or Moses in Egypt is actually far more interesting than images of the children of Israel in the Sinai desert or David herding sheep, so they're much more memorable. And the pyramids make a great background for any picture, and so does a great Sphinx. And and the fact is, if you get up close, and when they tell you the pyramids were the tallest buildings in the world up until the Washington Monument, which was quickly eclipsed by the Eiffel Tower. And so they held that record, probably never be broken, as to the tallest building in the world. But, these things make nice illustrations, and it gets our attention. Take this. This is Sir Lawrence Alma Tadema, and there's the Pharaoh's daughter has discovered the baby Moses in his ark. And if you notice, if you look up there real closely, you can see the pyramids. And there's actually a bunch of people along the land. It's just, it's hard to see it at this type of thing. But anyway, that's a picture that's really evocative. It gives you, a real... the things, if you go along the Nile in Cairo these days, it doesn't look like that. Okay. Lush riverbank, Moses in his ark, and there's illustrations, Joseph interpreting dreams for Pharaoh, the Dur illustrations in the Bible. These can't help but impress. And some of you, if you remember when I was a little boy, they had Saturday Night at the Movies on, and there were all kinds of movies, and one of the movies they showed was The Egyptian. Okay, and so needless to say, and when I was a little boy, here we are, and I'm in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we were talking about this movie, and it's pretty impressive. It had a pretty big Hollywood budget and things like that, and it got our attention. And this came out in 1954, but I wouldn't have seen it until a number of years later when it showed on television. And it was directed by Michael Curtis, wonderfully impressive sets and costumes, and if you've seen the movie, you'll remember Pharaoh comes into his throne room and the bald Egyptian priests have their staffs and they say, boom, boom, bow down before the living God. Okay, well, when I went to St. Joe Elementary School, which was actually a public school, I was just in first grade, but anyway, there was a vice principal there named Gada. Okay, and some clever little boys, and it was not me, not at all, I can't take credit for it. They'd be in the hallway and we'd walk by, they'd basically yell out, bow down before the living Gada. And so anyway, so this was impressive to kids. And then there's the Ten Commandments. Again, that's another movie that you can see it now. And it doesn't come across as cheap or cheesy with bad sets or anything like that. They did a great job with all the technical things. Lavish sets, special effects. Took prominence, again, a typical Cecil B. DeMille production. But the thing is, most of that movie is set in Egypt. Once they leave, and the thing is, they cross the Red Sea, the Egyptian army gets wiped out, Yul Brynner as Pharaoh is crushed by this experience and everything. And after that, they quickly get to Mount Sinai, get the Ten Commandments, boom, it's over. Okay, and there's very, they don't spend 40 years in the wilderness in the movie. Okay, and you do have some good scenes when Edward G. Robinson gets, sucked up into the earth by God's wrath and that type of stuff with his cronies. But anyway, why the fascination? Okay, and people talk about this, and one of the things they talk about is the idea Egypt is both exotic and familiar. Okay. You know, the fact of the matter is Egypt makes a great subject for elementary school social studies textbooks and things like that. So, and like, again, the visual images are great and this type of stuff. So we see all this stuff. At the same time, it's very exotic because hieroglyphics, you've got these animals and other pictorial representations. What does this mean? People have been fascinated by you know, those things for a long time, and there's other exoticism that's built up. Another thing, you know, for example, take Egypt. Okay, Hittites. We don't have a fascination with Hittites. For one thing, we didn't actually even know they existed except for a few references in the Bible until, you know, we didn't know much about the Hittites until they made the archaeological discoveries in the latter part of the 19th century. And Assyrians, you know, all we know is they were pretty mean. And Persians, and then if you go to India, you know, there'll be a little bit of fascination there, but not like Egypt. Same way with China, you know, there were stages where you had China's area, where people would collect Chinese things for their, you know, Victorian sitting rooms with all the bric-a-brac, but nothing approached Egypt. And again, none of these civilizations also had the type of monumental buildings that survived. You know, Egypt, the fact is, if you go to Egypt today, you don't see nearly the monuments that like a 18th century or 19th century traveler would have seen, because unfortunately under the pashas, they started grinding up some of the building material for lime and things like that, and a lot of that stuff was destroyed. And for example, if you go to Cairo and you go to the Citadel of Saladin and the big fortress that's there, most of that was made from stones that were pirated from the pyramids. Okay, so anyway, and take for example in China, you got the first emperor's tomb. Now it's elaborate, it's huge, but it's just not a pyramid. You know, it's not, you know, for 4,000 years the tallest building humans ever built. And the thing is, both the pyramids and the first emperor's tomb come across in a way as egotism in the minds of a lot of people. But when it comes to bulk, you just can't beat the pyramids. And like I said, they've been around 4,000 years. The first emperor's mausoleum's only been discovered in 1974. Now, then there's the architectural history. Egyptian influences were connected to this concept of the sublime, okay, that was in Romanticism. And the sublime was about when something basically inspired a sense of awe, and that sense of awe was perhaps accompanied by elements of dread and terror in it. Okay, so, you know, a sublime experience, for example, would be you're on a mountaintop and there's thunder and lightning. Thunder and lightning all over the place, and you could get struck by the thunder and lightning. Of course, you know, it's kind of scary, but at the same time, it's also really exciting. It's like, you know, if you're on a ship and there's a storm, I know my parents came over to visit me when I was in England, and we got on the ferry boat at Hook of Holland to go back to Harwich in England. And as soon as we cleared the harbor, boom, there was a huge storm in that part of the channel in the North Sea, and about 60% of the passengers were sick. I discovered that my parents and I all shared the same trait. We don't get seasick. But I thought, wow, this is great. I went up there and I looked out on the sea, and it was really fascinating. That's a sublime experience. And then I went down to the area and I was drinking some beer with Australians. It was just three of us, because a lot of other people couldn't keep the beer down. So anyway, again, visiting the pyramids or the great temples at Karnak, with their massive size, solidity, antiquity, this is also a sublime experience. And so it's not at all, you know, something that we should be surprised about, that people adopted Egyptianized motifs into public buildings, churches, and cemeteries. And, for example, okay, if you watch Law and Order, you know, what do? They're always saying, take that guy down to the tombs. And you sort of, hey, that, you know, when I first heard it, I didn't know where it came from. And I thought, well, that's kind of ominous to call a jail that. Well, the thing is, the building they're talking about no longer exists. That's the, you know, New York correctional facility, it no longer exists. Actually, the current building's either the third or fourth one that they've had, but because it was built like an Egyptian temple or a mausoleum, then it's the name Tombs has stuck ever since. Okay, now if you go down to Nashville, some of you have probably seen this, but the First Presbyterian Downtown Church was built on an Egyptian motif as well. And if you haven't visited it, it's very worthwhile to visit. If you go down there, you know, all of the pews are done with an Egyptian motif, and all the stuff on the altar is, and those are temple pyramids. And the bank next door has adopted some of the same motifs and things too. So anyway, that very interesting building. Unfortunately, in my book, we didn't use a color picture, so you really don't get to appreciate it the way this picture shows it. And again, cemeteries. Well, cemeteries, again, first of all, we a lot of times associate Egypt and death. Now, the fact of the matter is Egyptians were actually really interested in life, because a lot of the things they did with their death rituals was to, so you'd have the same life you had on earth forever, okay? And so they actually, their religion, you know, unlike the Mesopotamian religions, their religion was pretty optimistic in tone. But this is really picked up on a lot of cemeteries throughout the country. Now, the idea of the sublime also hooks up with Carl Jung. And now, I ran all this stuff by one of my colleagues in psychology to make sure that I wasn't, you know, screwing it up or anything, because, you know, being a historian, it'd be easy for me to do that. But the thing is, Jung, he theorized that people have a collective unconsciousness. We have a lot of ideas hardwired into our brains. And collective unconsciousness consists of things that he called archetypes and myths. Okay. And according to Jung, archetypes are images that have been present in the human psyche from time out of mind. Okay. And what you're talking about, like with archetypes, is like, for example, let's take Star Wars. All right. Yoda. Okay, he's the wise old man. But so's Obi-Wan Kenobi. Okay, then you look at the seven samurai. There's the village elder that's out in the woods that the villagers go to get all the advice from you, because he's the guy. It's really good. They're going, oh, the bandits are going to attack us. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? We need help. And he says, you need to get samurai. And, well, how will we do that? We don't have any money. Find hungry samurai. And so, anyway, and the thing, and he says, even the bear comes out of the woods when he's hungry. And if in Japanese, the word for bear is kuma. And so if you listen, you'll hear, he's kuma. And so I go, hey, it's right. He really did say it. So anyway, Jung came up with this. And myths are stories that arise out of the archetype. So the wise old man archetype, Star Wars, you know, Seven Samurai. Of course, that also gets translated into the Magnificent Seven and all kinds of movies. You can, when you have these stock characters, all right? And the ancient culture, Egyptian civilization, is a rich repository of archetypes and related myths. Okay, now, a good example of this is the goddess Isis. Okay, she's the great goddess archetype. A very well-developed archetype, okay? And again, for the Egyptians, the myths associated with Isis, Osiris, and Horus are a very significant part of their religion. And Richard, when he reviewed my book, he commented that in my book, I don't discuss that television series, The Secrets of Isis, because I didn't know it existed until after the book had already gone to the publisher. And what happened was, when I was in Cambridge, I'm living in England, so I got this like 4-year hiatus on American television. And so, you know, like, I'd never experienced Three's a Company either. So who's Suzanne Summers? You know, so anyway, in Jungian terms, the great goddess was a compelling archetype, and so Isis has been popular throughout time. She's a great goddess, and in the ancient Mediterranean world, the cult of Isis was all over the place. Some of you may have read, you know, The Last Days of Pompeii, because, again, that's got a temple of Isis scene attached to it, and And in fact, Isis actually kind of intervenes to help out a woman that's in trouble from an evil priest. And so and it was all over the place. I noticed, I heard somebody say something about Mykonos. Oh, okay, yeah. Have you been to Mykonos? Okay, have you been to Delos? It's the island right next to it.
No.
Oh, okay. It's now a desert island, but in ancient times, 50,000 people lived on Delos, and they had running water and stuff like it. It was a big slave mart where the Romans took all of the captives, and they were sold and scattered out. And if you go there, there's a hill, and there's a monument to Jupiter Zeus at the top, but halfway up there's a temple to Isis as well. But since I was on a cruise ship tour, I didn't have time to hike it and everything. I told my wife, next time we go to Mykonos, we're going to Delos, we're cutting out from the cruise ship tour, and we're going to hike that hill. So I want to see it. So anyway, and my wife's a much better walker than I am, so she's all for it. Okay, so anyway, Isis was a serious rival to early Christianity, that cult. Now, the series here appeared in 1975, and it only had 1 year, and I would really like to watch it, but they really want an arm and a leg for that DVD, so, and it's not on Netflix. So anyway, the plot is that it's a rather unremarkable high school teacher by day is a superhero goddess by night. That's the premise. And this was actually the first television series to feature a female superhero, because she predated both the Wonder Woman series and the Bionic Woman series that came out the next year. Now, the thing is, to be fair to Wonder Woman, they'd been talking about having a series about her from the mid-60s onward, and there was a made-for-TV movie with Kathy Lee Crosby in 1974, but the first real television series was still Secrets of Isis. And so anyway, another trait that makes Egypt fascinating, I've already talked about, is very great age. It was thought that Egypt was the oldest of the civilizations. Oh, that's too soon. Okay, and now we know that Sumer is older, and actually there are probably some others as well that were up in Turkey, and who knows what they're going to finally discover about what's underwater in the Black Sea as well. They're trying to come up with some of that. But anyway, an Egyptian motif is always an attention getter, and political cartoonists have used this. Okay, now this is from the election of 1884, and the title is called The Receiving Vault of Republican Politicians Who Defied Public Morality. Now, I'm thinking that given our situation today, somebody could probably go in and revise some of the faces on that cartoon. But anyway, this is an example of the work of Bernard Gillam. He was, and what happens is, this is like James G. Blaine is being brought in to be buried. And he was a prominent Republican politician who ran for a president. You might recall, for example, in that election, that was when Grover Cleveland was running, and there was the issue. Now, Grover Cleveland was one of the people that we elected to the presidency who was a bachelor when he went into the White House. And the Republican, and by the way, we talk about people coming up with dirty stuff about candidates. Okay, the Republicans discovered that Grover Cleveland had been paying out money to a woman with regard to an illegitimate child. It turns out he was the front man paying for a married judge who was actually the father of this baby. But anyway, they brought this. So when Republican crowds would get together, they'd basically say, "Ma, ma, where's my pa? Going to the White House, ha, ha, ha." And the Democrats, on the other hand, would say, James G. Blaine, continental liar from the state of Maine. But the Republicans had a better chant, I think. Okay. Now, anyway, Gillam was born in England. He was an American citizen. He actually was a Republican, but his cartoons really went a long way to help defeat Blaine, because he was in a different faction of the Republican Party. But then 8 years later, however, Grover Cleveland also got the Egyptomania treatment, because this is the election of 1892, and he's there, and so is Adlai Stevenson, the first Adlai Stevenson. And And again, they're mummies. And you want to keep in mind that unwrapping mummies was a big thing. People would actually, you know, first of all, they'd have a public showing. It'd be some, you know, someplace like you'd get a gallery at Western Kentucky University, and somebody'd buy a mummy, and they'd unwrap it. Now, a lot of times they had a little trouble with this because the mummies, like a lot of the bitumen that went in there, had hardened so much that they were having to take a chisel to try and get the mummy wrappings off and things like that. But anyway, that was a big phenomenon. And Edgar Allan Poe story is based on that, you know, talk with a mummy. And anyway, so they would do this. Now, another thing you probably will recall that Ben Carson made the comment that the pyramids were actually the granaries of Joseph. Okay, now that's pretty medieval, because during the Middle Ages, that's what Western Europeans did think, okay? And by the way, they'd say that big building, that where Joseph must have, you know, just stored all that grain. However, you know, the fact is, since, you know, Herodotus talked to the Egyptians, they'd be, yeah, they're tombs. So, you know, the thing is, so not just Dr. Carson, but also all these people, well, they're alien observatories, or their landing spots, or their power plants and stuff like that. And, you know, ancient Egyptians had no myths that gigantic gods built these pyramids. Okay, what they told Herodotus was, you know, we're really mad at those pharaohs for making us work on that stuff so long, and things like that. So, anyway, but Egyptomania and the occult have long been associated. Rosicrucians use Egyptian symbols and architecture, and also so do Theosophists and the Masons. Now, the thing is, actually, in true Masonry, Egypt has very little to do with it. Masonry is about the builders of the Temple of Solomon. And so the best you could say is extend it to say that they learned their skills from the Egyptians. But actually, Hiram was a Jewish person that worked for Solomon, built the temple. At least that's in the myth of the Masons. Okay, but at the same time, Masonry has its own Egyptomania, because if you look at a lot of Masonic temples, they all have different meeting rooms. There's almost always going to be an Egyptian motif room. Like out in, there's a big Masonic temple out in Oklahoma, which I think probably dates from the oil industry getting started. And I've not been out there to visit that. And the biggest Masonic temple in the world is in Detroit. And it's got an Egyptian room. But there's a really large Masonic temple in Fort Wayne where I grew up. And the man was nice enough to give me a tour. And there's Egyptian motif room there, and it is very, very common to have that. Secret societies associate themselves with Egypt because Egypt's associated with secrets and secret knowledge. And so if you want to have veneration if antiquity conveys respectability, you can't have better company than Egypt. And so people would do that. And if you look, it basically says, please don't go to any trouble with the burial. Just seal me up in one of those big pyramid-shaped green storage thingies. So ever since I wrote this book, people send me cartoons like this. So anyway, Egyptomania and the occult. Okay, this man here, look at that. He's got this, the whole Egyptian headgear. His name is Samuel Little McGregor Mathers, and he was one of the big leaders of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which in fact was very well associated with Egyptian lore. Now, Egypt is also associated with pseudo-history. These are just two fairly recent covers from Atlantis Rising, and Egypt always makes the cover, and I was just going over and look at the magazine shelf, and you'll see actually plenty of books on plenty of magazines that have something to do with Egypt over there as well. Again, people are fascinated by it. And Egypt, like I said, is frequently the focus of pseudo-historical theories. Ancient aliens built the pyramids. Atlanteans built the pyramids. And Ice Age super-civilization built the pyramids. And the thing about it is all these people that say this publicly never argue with each other. they only argue with actually the mainstream archaeologists and say, oh, those guys, they're so closed-minded and ignorant. Now, I actually managed to go to one of these conferences where these people get together, and that's when you see the internal rivalries come out and everything. When there's no mainstream scholars that they know of in the room, they'll be arguing with each other, and they've got all the petty jealousies and rivalries that academics have. So, anyway, you have this again. The Great Sphinx is 10,000 years old. That's a biggie. And you know, for example, Robert Schock, the guy who puts this idea forward, he said, "Well, look at this erosion. This had to have occurred when." There was rain in Egypt, and it was rainier 10,000 years ago. Well, you know, he's supposed to be a geologist, but the trouble is none of the other geologists agree with him. And when I looked at it, I actually did earth science for a minor as an undergraduate, and I thought, that doesn't look like water erosion all that much. It looks in, and because the way the stones are and things, but he sold a lot of books on that basis. So, anyway, one of my friends was talking, when we were looking around for a publisher for Invented Knowledge, he was talking to this editor he worked with, and the editor told him, he said, well, it's sad to say, but, you know, really, one of the principles we have in publishing is bunk sells, debunking doesn't. And so, anyway, so the thing is, but this stuff, if you really look into it, the history of it, most of these pseudo-historical ideas have been around since well early in the 19th century, and they just keep getting recycled. One of the reasons why is you get these 19th century books, people go to a bookstore, somebody reprints them, somebody reads it, and they basically, anything that's between two covers has got to be authoritative, right? And so they'll see that, and okay. And the fact of the matter is actually a lot of commercial publishers publish things because, well, it's really kind of bad scholarship. It's a crummy idea, but people are going to buy a lot of copies of this. So, you know, they want to make money. And anyway, all of this is part of people's fascination with ancient Egypt. It goes way back. The ancient Hebrews had a love-hate relation with Egypt. Take, for example, Egypt was a land of refuge. Abraham went there to hide out from a famine. Jacob and his sons went there to hide out from a famine. Prophet Jeremiah went there to hide out from the Babylonians. Mary and Joseph went there to hide out from Herod the Great. Okay, but it was also a land of bondage. And again, this is Israel in Egypt. And again, could be seen typically out of the Ten Commandments, except obviously 1867. He would have been an inspiration for Cecil B. DeMille, not the other way around. And the Greeks were just as fascinated by ancient Egypt as Heliodorus, who wrote a book called The Ethiopica, put it. Greeks find all Egyptian lore and legend irresistibly attractive. And the fact is, this has stayed with us to this very day. It's not something most of us acquire because we make a trip to Egypt. We make a trip to Egypt because we acquired an interest from history books, novels, films, and paintings and all of that stuff. So thank you very much, and I'll answer some questions if you have any.
Did you coin the word Egyptomania?
Oh, no, not at all. No, it's yeah, the word Egyptomania has been used for quite a long time by art historians and architectural historians. Sometimes they call it Egyptian revival, but like there's this man named Curl. His book's been in three editions, and the second edition was called Egyptomania, and the third edition was called the Egyptian Revival. Yeah.
I just found out that there are episodes of Secrets of Isis on YouTube.
I never think to look there when I'm teaching a class and stuff comes up. The students have to tell me it's there. I'm okay with it. And the other thing, though, is when you're teaching a class, you got to watch it about telling the students to go to YouTube, because you never want to put it in writing, because then you could be accused of collaborating in the violation of somebody's copy. So Anyway, not that, why would they come after, you know, history professor? I mean, like, what, we got money? What are they thinking? You
know, so. Did the modern fascination with Egypt start with the Napoleon's invasion?
Yeah, that'd be pretty much it. Yeah,
because
it was the first. Oh, excuse me. Okay, he asked, did modernist Egyptomania fascination with Egypt start with Napoleon's expedition to Egypt? And yeah, the answer to that would be yes. It was because, like, what happened is Napoleon goes there, and he brought along like 160 scholars, and they did a huge study of Egypt, the description of Egypt. And in fact, you know, it's like 20 volumes, and the one edition is really, really big. And I don't know who they expected to buy this thing. It was heavily subsidized by the French government. But, you know, and what happened was it started under Napoleon, but then Napoleon fell, and the Bourbons were restored, and then they had to excise all the references to Napoleon out of it, and then a later edition came along. They've got a copy at Vanderbilt. I've been wanting to go there and take a look at it just to see, because apparently it's just huge. And people would see that, though, and they're wonderful illustrations. But the thing is, more importantly, this Vivant Denon, who was the first curator of the Louvre, Napoleon gave him that job because the Louvre was started by Napoleon. But he was with Napoleon in Egypt, and actually, what happened with Denon is, like, the man who was the head of the Mamelukes that the French had driven out of power had his army in Upper Egypt, and so Napoleon had one of his generals, Dessous, pursuing this guy, and Denon went along with him, and it was really interesting. He wrote a whole book about this experience, which had his own illustrations. And this, he was really interesting because he'd been friends with the Bourbons. He was a French nobleman, fled the country because of the Reign of Terror, but he was friends with Josephine. And that's how he got to know Napoleon. And that was his in. And he was one of the people who went back with Napoleon when he got on the frigate and abandoned his army. Anyway, but he was the first curator, but then he got kicked out by the Bourbons from the king. But he wrote this book, and it's like, Vivant Denon was talking about, like, Richard, he'd be there sketching ruins while the Mamelukes were shooting at him. So he was pretty dedicated. And he talked about, did you go down to Karnak in that area?
Yeah.
Okay, but he talked about when the French army arrived there, and they came around the area and they first saw all the temples. The whole army started in applause because they were, you know, just so, you know, knocked out by.
And they just rise up out of the desert.
Yeah. And so, you know, we can all experience that. So. Oh.
What about Egyptian clothing? Did you comment about how Egyptian culture has influenced clothing in over time? Is that something you?
Oh, you know, there's a fair amount of jewelry out there that takes that on.
We have our
cartridge. Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. I got the cat here. It's fast. I had another one that was hieroglyphics. And by the way, you know, just like a rubber ducky, you can get them at the British Library. My wife gets disgusted because I'm a sucker for stuff like that. But they had a buy two, get one free sale the last time we were there. And I got her two scarves and I got my tie. So she was happy. And actually, she liked the Egyptian motif stuff. It's just, she thinks I'm silly.
Other questions? Yes.
Kind of building off of your answer previously, do you know the title of that book? Was it translated into English?
Oh, yeah. It's available. Now, you can if you just look up Vivant Denon, and it's we can look in the book.
Yeah,
I
have it here. Yeah.
It's
great.
Oh, it's
published
by Kosh.
Oh yeah, I appreciate that too. The trouble is, you go into Amazon and they got those reprints that are not all that nice, you know, from some of those companies. And a while ago, that company Peter Smith did a reprint of it, which was pretty nice, but I can never find that one on the used market. So, anyway.
Other questions? You mentioned it in some place in the book about American rock stars like to use Egyptian motifs on.
Oh, you know, the if you remember that Walk Like an Egyptian song.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, one thing I found out was, in the introduction, I was talking about that, and I had to cut back. I quoted a verse from a song, and then the people at Reaction told me I had to take it out, because fair use for song lyrics is much, much stricter than it is for books. And it's the same way, Katy Perry had that controversial video where the guy with the Quranic quote gets burnt up. The thing is, she burnt up the Muslim guy. Yeah, but she did that to about six other guys too. You know, so it wasn't anything personal. She was just doing a lot of guys in. She was like an ISIS figure herself. I mean, some guy brought her, Cheetos that had hot sauce on them, and he died. And that type of stuff. You got this song. So I'm sitting there laboriously, making sure I'm transcribing the lyric correctly and looking them up on the internet. And we put them in the book, and they said, "You got to take it out." And I said, "Well, how about if I call her?" Because one thing I wanted was a picture. And there were pictures on the internet, and we had to get permission. And they never answered back. So anyway, I was very disappointed in Katy Perry. But then I think,
well, at least he didn't get poofed.
Right, I know. Yeah. If I'd have used it illegally, I would have.
Well, on behalf of our sponsor, I want to especially thank our speaker for driving all the way from Alabama to be with us tonight. A little token of our appreciation.